Fangoria presents Class of 80.
Is anyone else alive? Are they all dead?
Yes, ma'am. Two of my men pulled you out of the lake. We thought you were dead, too. Do you remember very much?
The boy. Is he dead, too?
Who?
The boy, Jason.
Jason?
In the lake. The one who attacked me. The one who pulled me underneath the water.
Ma'am, we didn't find any boy.
But then he's still there.
Welcome to Class Of. I'm your host, Natasha Pacetta, the Vanguard of the Vault here at Fangoria. This year marks the 40th anniversary of Friday the 13th, and Adrian King is here to share her memories from Camp Crystal Lake. Adrian talks about the audition process for Alice, her choreographed fight with Betsy Palmer, how her mom helped sell the movie to Paramount, her illustrious and unconventional career. Did you know that she was in Ghostbusters and Titanic? Right? Crazy. Find out about that and much more. But before we get to Adrian, I want to tell you about Fangoria's latest movie. Porno is now available on demand. When five teen employees at the local movie theater in a small Christian town discover a mysterious old film hidden in its basement, they unleash an alluring succubus who gives them a sex education written in blood. See the movie some moms are calling not family friendly at all. Porno is available on demand right now. And I want to tell you about Tom Savini's special makeup effects program. Have you ever wanted to create amazing monsters and characters and work in special makeup effects? This is what students are learning at Tom Savini's Special Makeup Effects Program. In this 16-month hands-on program, you learn every aspect of the industry, and you come out with a degree. Graduates work on just about every big film and TV show out there, everything from the Avengers series, Stranger Things, Guardians of the Galaxy, Walking Dead, Westworld, The Mandalorian, The Conjuring, X-Men, It, Darkest Hour, Lost in Space, the list goes on and on. Graduates are also working in dental labs, theater, the haunt industry, the toy industry, as well as medical prosthetics. For more information, go to dec.edu. Now let's hear from Adrian. Let's talk a little bit about your character, Adrian. Let's talk about Alice. Walk us through the audition process for this character.
Oh, my goodness. Way back when, the summer of 1979 in New York City. It was the entire summer, basically, of casting. And it was an open call. I only had a commercial agent at the time. I didn't even have a theatrical agent. And I was doing plays off-Broadway and off-Broadway and lots of commercials and, you know, extras dancing behind this Saturday Night Fever and Hair, you know, all those things that one does trying to make your mark as an actress and build up your resume. And I remember that summer hearing about an audition, and it was an open call. And like I said, everybody from the ages of probably 16 to 26, even older probably or younger, auditioned for summer, and boys and girls, and no one knew what it was about, really, but, you know. And I just remember auditioning with hundreds of other young actors in New York City, and Sean Cunningham and Steve Miner and Barry Moss and Julie Hughes, who were the actual casting people on Broadway, and they were fabulous. And Barry just recently passed, but oh my goodness, they were the casting agents for most of theater on Broadway and off Broadway at that time. So I really think that had a lot to do with having such a good ultimate cast, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
And so I got callback after callback after callback, and paired with different, you know, like Harry Crosby and Kevin Bacon at different times, because we didn't know who we were ultimately testing for, you know, or for. And it wasn't until, you know, several callbacks later, and then Sean said, okay, you're going to screen test now. And so that was my first ever screen test, you know. And yeah, and I think there were probably six other girls and young ladies. And sure enough, we had to do all these different kind of improv situations more so than actual dialogue, because as you know, the dialogue was slightly limited in the movie. So it was a lot of improv and a lot of screens. And later that afternoon, I remember getting phone calls from Sean, not from, you know, anyone else, Sean directly, saying, well, you're my Alice. And I went, oh my God, I can't believe this. Awesome. And we started shooting the day after Labor Day, the Tuesday after Labor Day, 1979.
Wow.
At Bilby Bosco, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, in New Jersey, Blairstown, New Jersey.
Exactly, your old stomping grounds.
Yeah, my old
right?
stomping grounds, yeah. I remember distinctly watching Friday the 13th for the first time in New Jersey, when because I grew up there, and being like, when I went to, you know, ask my friends, like, hey, have you seen Friday the 13th? And they were like, yeah, it's filmed in New Jersey, so Jason could be anywhere.
Exactly, right? And now we get to go back to the camp where it all took place, believe it or not, because the Boy Scouts are smart enough now. It took them 38 years to figure it out, but they embrace their fans now. And we do weekends, Friday the 13th weekends, or in this case, I think coming up in May, the 40th anniversary, I think we're going to do an event there where we open the camp out. And it's such a surreal experience. It's truly like, you know, living the dream. If you were ever into the movie, and so many people from around the world are, and this is like reliving your youth, you know, literally, when you drive up the long road to the camp, you just feel like, you know, you're a kid again.
How does that feel for you specifically, you know, going back to the spot where, you know, this little movie that, you know, no one knew was going to explode like it did. You know, what is that like? And, you know, it must be a rush.
It's a total rush. And it's so surreal is the only word I can really adequately describe it. If you can imagine in 1979, when I left that camp for the last time, we didn't even know if we had a movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right? Because it was film. It was film. You didn't get to look at your video right away.
Right.
And we only had a couple of takes that last time to do it. And I felt like we had nailed it. But it's like you just don't know. And then to come back 40 years later and watch the movie, which is now a cult movie, on the beach where you literally, you know, stumbled around with Betsy Palmer and
right.
head into the beach. And it's watching it with the other campers. I call them my campers. You know that.
Yeah.
All other campers sitting there, you know, just living this most surreal scenario, watching the movie that we all identify our childhood and the boogeyman with, you know, and here we are watching it together as a community, as a family, you know. It's such a trip.
That's amazing. It's so cool. I mean, Friday the 13th fans are just so fantastic. I love them, and I'm one of them. And
the best.
They are the best.
Absolutely. My happy campers.
Yes, we're all campers here.
We're all campers. I don't have to put the happy on. That's too much pressure, you know.
Let's talk about something you just mentioned, you know, rolling around with Betsy Palmer on the beach. And that is one scene that, you know, always, always stands out to me in the movie. And it looks so real. And I'm always like, oh my gosh, these two women are just going at it. And I wanted to know from your experience, you know, what that was actually like shooting that scene. Just kind of take us back to that moment in time.
Well, Natasha, you know why it looks real? Because it was. you know, had no stunt doubles. And, you know, film was very expensive. So we had to choreograph that. Also, we were using real weapons. really smashing and biting. And because Betsy, God bless her soul, loved her so much, but on the movie, we were kept apart by Sean. He was very smart because he probably feeling that we would have developed a relationship, which we did later on. We were very close, but we were kept apart on the set. And she told me very early on, honey, if you're going to survive this one, you better fight back. <You know? laughs> And she was extremely method. And I always say she brought my game way up. You know, it's like she was just the best. And to work opposite her, it was truly, you couldn't miss a beat because you were going to go down if you did.
Wow.
What you saw on the screen was just incredibly a spontaneous choreographed piece, if you understand what that means.
Yeah, I think I get it. There's steps involved, but there's, you know, some very method acting going on.
Absolutely. And we worked off each other beautifully. And, you know, when we're biting each other, we are going at it. And when she's slamming my head in the sand, she's really slamming my head in the sand. We were battered and bruised as we walked off that beach. And it literally, we started as the sun went down the night before, shot through the entire night, and finished as the sun was rising. We were wrapping. And I found Sean's notes 25 years later from that choreographed scene. I called it the ballet of the machete. And I actually made a poster. It's long sold out now, but I have the original notes, and there were 13 of them, if you can believe that. Not 12, not 14. Yeah, 13. I think I have the notes on my website if you want to check them out. They're really very cool. And it says, like, Tom Savini does this, Betsy does this, Adrian does this, Tasha does, you know, it really, it shows you how it totally was choreographed. Nothing left up to chance, but then once the camera started going, oh my God, there was just no holding back.
Wow, that's amazing. I love hearing that too, because, you know, there's just something about, you know, those kinds of movies, and Friday the 13th is just like a time capsule of them, of like, you know, let's try it and let's do it. And like, you know, absolutely, let's like really go for it. And I love that so much. And I you know, it's, I think after all these years, it was worth the couple, you know, black and blue marks.
Forever, I am so thrilled that we had no money on that movie, because stunt people, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know,
and it would have been different. And, you know, even in part two, they could afford stunt people. And for us, it just made it work. If we didn't do our own stunts, you would have lacked so much in cutaways and so much.
Right,
but,
right.
But yeah, it was totally worth the bruises. You're right.
I love it. Let's talk about the ending sequence, which is everyone can see in their mind's eye the ending sequence with you in the canoe. And it's such a beautiful, it looks like such a beautiful day. And, you know, Jason pops up and ruins that, of course. Spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen Friday the 13th, which they absolutely need to do immediately.
What amazes me is how that last scene, that scare, still holds up 40 years later. You know, it really still packs that punch when young Jason pops out of the water. And, oh, my God, people still jumped and still screamed, and it's just truly amazing. Even if you know the ending, it's still, because I think it's that perfect lulling, the music, the soft music, and, you know, just the scene just lulls you into that sense of false security, and boom, you know.
Oh, definitely.
I think Harry Manfredini has a lot to do with that, personally. You know, the music, and I think I've told this story a couple of times. I don't know if you know it, but when we were screening it for distributors early in 1980, I asked Sean Cunningham if I could let my mom come to one of the screenings, invite her to one of the screenings. And there's only like 20 seats in these screening rooms. And we were sitting in the first couple of rows, and the distributors were in the back row with Sean. And we're watching the movie, and it's winter out, so my mom has her like coat on this thing. And, you know, during the strip Monopoly scene, she's like all nervous, and it's like, chill, mom, it's cool, you know, when it's gonna come. And then she's like, my mom's a tough cookie, you know, and she's like, oh, you know, when is this over kind of thing. And she gets her coat as the, you know, she thinks it's the ending, and I'm like, quiet, watch the movie. And of course she totally gets nailed, jumps out of her seat 10 feet, lets out a scream that put mine to shame, and I finally realized where I got my good scream genes, I say. And I turn around and I look at Sean, and he's shaking hands with Mr. Warner Brothers and Mr. Paramount. And that's when the day we sold the movie to Warner Brothers for International and Paramount.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and I always said my mom had a little something to do with it.
Wow, what a cool moment. And it's so cool that your mom got to be a very important part of, you know, making Friday the 13th a success. You know, keeping it in the family. That's awesome.
Pretty funny. You know, here she was like thinking it's over, and it's like, no, thank you for helping sell our movie.
Yeah, no, that is the exact reaction that I'm sure Sean was hoping for. And
yeah, you know, I'm sure we'd have sold it quickly anyway, but it probably made it a little quicker.
Absolutely. Wow, that's so cool. I love that. And the ending, you know, it is very powerful. And I know the first time I can, you know, see it so clearly in my head when I saw it, and just being like so freaked out. But that was actually shot after production had wrapped, because Sean wanted to come in and do it. You know, a stronger ending. So talk a little bit about what it was like to be on set that day or consequent days.
It was mid-October. I actually have my 1979 diary. I never throw anything away. I found all of these goodies, including his notes, diary, and all these Polaroids, continuity Polaroids that people would throw out just in case. You know, I collect them. I was going to make a collage of the movie, never went, you know, was sold or finished.
Oh my gosh.
Well, I'm sure Sean told you we ran out of money a little bit here and there, you know.
Yeah, it happens.
So you know, I was gonna do that, but no, we came back, and it was chilly, and I remember sitting on the warming tray, they called it a bun warmer, and it was really warming my buns in the camp kitchen, the Boy Scout kitchen, and I was listening to radio with the cook in there, and it was like, good morning, Blairstown, it's 39 degrees outside, you know.
Ooh.
And it was cold, and already Tom Savini was in the water with Ari, you know, with Sean, and setting up the shot, because it pre-sunrise, because, you know, he knew what he wanted. He did want it stronger, and this was going to do it. But we only had one change of clothes, and it all came down. And not to mention, you know, the light. Light is so important.
Right.
And we had three cameras going. Did tell you slow-mo, because the first we kept on having to, you know, save up for more cameras, basically, and more film. And by the time we got them all together, it was October, I believe it was October 12th, Friday, October 12th, I think it was.
Oh, wow.
So the first time I fell out of camera range, so only one more time, quickly they blew me dry, my hair dry, and my, you know, my everything, and get me back into the canoe. And I always say my finest moment was not giving away how cold that water was on the, you know, to the audience, just trying to forget it all and get back into my, you know, quiet brain and think that all is good on the lake until one more time was just, like I said, so surreal to film it, leave that morning from the campsite and not know how we, how or if we had a finished movie, yeah. Literally, you know. But oh my goodness, Susan, the editor, Sean's wife at the time, certainly edited beautifully, and Sean knew what he wanted, and certainly packed a punch in that scene, and you know, and then added the little hospital clinic scene at the end, which was perfect little way to get on to part two. So kind of magical in its own way.
You look so relaxed in that canoe, and it's kind of cool to hear, like, oh, you know, it was freezing and you know, you only had a certain amount of takes you could do it in, and you know, you do play it very well, and it's almost like it's a very Hallmark scene, you know, right before Jason comes
absolutely.
In
absolutely very Hallmark. Yes, and we go from Hallmark to horror.
Yes, Hallmark to horror. Did you know that Ari was going to look like that for that scene?
Yeah, I had seen him, his Polaroids and whatever. But, you know, from behind, I still haven't seen him, really.
Yeah.
It's only underwater while we're swimming together that I actually get a glimpse of them, but you know, audience never sees that.
Nice. Yeah, I mean,
it's my backstory, it's my dream, you know.
Right, it's right.
What actors do to make it work for them, you know.
What were you thinking about at that time? Like,
so I was just thinking probably that, thank God I'm still alive, and what part of that was a dream, you know, and what part was real, you know. That's all I can. I probably, when I was actually going through the contemplation and clearing my brain, it's basically I was just trying to think of nothing.
Right.
Just clear out everything and think of nothing and basically meditate, you know, and that's so you get the full impact.
Yeah, and you do. For sure.
Yeah, seriously. So, but seriously, was tested. I was tested, and 40 years later, I think I passed my test.
Yes, yeah. I think we will all say that you passed, Adrienne. And you're good.
Yeah. Everyone still jumps. All is good.
Yes. After yeah. Friday the 13th, you moved to London to study.
I did.
I'd love to know, like, you know, when you went over there, what was the reaction from people in the UK about Friday the 13th? And
huge fans, huge.
Wow.
They're like my second family. UK. I love my Stuart Morris and Jen Morris. Have Misty Moon Film Society over there in London, and they're like my second family. And I go over every 3 years. And yeah, I went to school over there basically as a dodge in my own way to get away from a little of the insanity. I'm sure you know the stalker history of what happened after part one, during part two, and subsequent to that. And it was before stalking laws, and I encountered a crazy person, a psychopath, and without stalking laws, man, they could basically get away with anything until you were physically assaulted. And so, you know, it was a real tough time. And part of my dealing with it was auditioning for Rod at Royal Academy and saying, please take me. And they did. God bless them. And it was wonderful for me as an actress. It was fabulous. And it's a real growth time for me as a person. And like I said, it's my second home. I love the people over there, and they were very welcoming to me. And then I came back and I had a screen test for All My Children, and got the role in within the first time on in the wings, waiting to go on backstage. I had an anxiety attack, my first anxiety attack related to acting ever, and I grew up acting. And I grew up acting, and that's when I knew, and that's when I discussed with my agent. I said, this isn't going to work for me anymore. Obviously, more damage has been done than I realized. And so I went into the world of voiceovers, and Again, you know, not what I had anticipated doing with my acting world, but it was so much fun and it kept me, you know, with my pinky still in the business. And it was another way to go. I always say to people who want to be in this business, keep all fields open, keep your eyes open in every direction, because you never know what's going to work for you. And you might actually enjoy another aspect of it. And I really did. I enjoyed voiceovers and looping, and I did some really cool movies. And it wasn't until, I always say, I just have to wrap this little part up, because it really does go from London and Rada, and it's trying to escape my, you know, basically the Friday the 13th legacy to 2003 or 4, when Peter Brackey, who wrote Crystal Lake Memories, unearthed me. I had done 7 years of looping on Melrose Place, God bless Beth Wernick and Lollapaloopers, because it kept me employed on a lot of spelling shows, and it wasn't until Peter Brackey basically writing Crystal Lake Memories, because he was such a huge fan, and explained to me about the three generations around the world of Friday the 13th fans. And how they really were curious what had happened to me, because, you know, it was before social media, you have to remember. So there was no way of really plugging into my fan base or knowing about them unless, you know, I showed up at, I guess, you know, premieres of horror movies, which I did not. So I didn't know. And in 2004, I went to my first convention. Peter said, "You got to do it." And it was Chiller. And that's where I met Stacey Lee first. And that's where I met so many of the diehard Friday fans first time around. And I still see them. They'll show up every, you know, if they can, to different conventions I'm at, or, you know, a premiere or two. I've done some little horror films or big horror films. Killer Therapy I have coming out, which is like knocking them dead, I hear.
Ooh.
At the film. Yeah, and Tales of Poe, Bart Mastronardi's, and Alan Moe Kelly's, and Michael Verratti wrote Dreams. Really beautiful pieces I've done. But it wasn't until 2004 at Chiller that I met some of these people and shared with them the stalking story during one of the Q&As. When someone said, "Where have you been for the past 24 years?" And I say, "Well, I had a stalker." And Betsy goes, "Betsy Bummer, what? You had a what?" I go, "Yeah." She goes, "How come I didn't know?" And I was like, "Nobody talked about it, Betsy. Nobody talked about stalkers back then. You know, they just didn't." And so it was the first time in that room, in that Q&A, which it felt like there were hundreds of people in the audience. I don't know how many were there, but we all shared a moment, and it's when I felt, honestly, the piece of my heart heal, I say.
Aww.
That my heart, that I never knew what was missing in terms of why it still felt a little I thought it was all healed, you know, through massive therapy. I thought everything was good, but it just took that little bit of fan camaraderie, you know, that give and take, which is really why I totally appreciate my fans caring enough about what had happened to me. And we shared a lot in that moment, and I carry it with me. And you know, my fans, I think, feel it.
Oh, definitely. And that's so touching to hear that, you know, you when you came around to the convention circuit and were starting to meet Friday the 13th fans, that, you know, it really helped you in a profound way. And I think that is something to be said of the horror community. We're all very nice people who, understand whatever we're all going through, you know, similar things and hard times. And I think there's something very healing about this community.
Well, you know, Natasha, that's what I kind of figured out. It took me a long time. It really did. But over the course since 2004, since I've been going to the conventions and since social media has been there for me to, you know, keep in touch with my fans, I feel that Alice and I have a lot in common. You know, we both have gone through post-traumatic shock in different ways. And I think we're both survivors. And I say to my fans, if you're sitting here in this room with me right now, or you're listening to me on your podcast right now, well, we have a lot in common because we're both survivors. We're all survivors because you don't get through this lifetime unscathed. You really don't. And we all go through something. And I think the purpose, my purpose here in this world now is to let people know they are not alone, that we all share this and we are a family. The heart community is a very strong family and we don't judge each other. We accept each other for who we are, and that's what makes us different. Mm-hmm. And outsiders don't get it. They really don't get us, people.
No.
They don't, you know. And even my artwork is, God bless, collected by people around the world because they are moved by it. I have some pieces that were saved during my dark art period. My art, you know, I graduated from FIT. I was accepted in fine arts. My art has always been my back burner. It's been my therapy. When something isn't working out, I always go back to my art, and it infuses me. And I find so many people in the art community have art in their, or music, or some second to fall back on, which is always the way art's been for me. And it's now become my priority because I feel art is healing for everyone. And my paintings and my chiclets and my paintings, I have to tell you, I ship them out around the world and people tell me how much they mean to me and how just having, you know, that piece of me with them gives them a feeling of security. And it touches me. It humbles me like you can't believe. And so that's my, I feel why I do what I'm doing now. You know, that I think we need to know we're there for each other.
Absolutely. And that's amazing about your art and like to have people be inspired, like for 40 years later, you know, people still inspired by you and your life story, you know, as, you know, yourself, Adrienne King, and also your character, Alice, in Friday the 13th, because she is literally the lone survivor of that movie.
You know, a final girl is now something to attain to. Yeah, I didn't realize this, but final girls, you know, they're cool now, and I get why they're cool. You know, there's a group of us now that exists.
Yeah, going back to what you said, like, you know, you and Alice, very parallel people, and you just project such a strongness and like fearlessness. The aura that you project is just really amazing, and I think the fans can really benefit from that for sure.
Well, I say Alice was not a warrior. She did everything she could not to engage in battle, you know, but she was a survivor. And when push came to shove, she wanted to see the next day, you know, and she, when it came down to it, man, she picked up that machete and went for it, you know, but it's not like she went out there looking for it. And that's how I feel a lot of us are. You know, we're basically peace killing people here.
Yeah.
We get our jollies out in the theater or together watching a good scary movie.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, leave us alone.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, the other thing with my, I was going to bring up the Crystal Lake Wines business too.
Yeah,
it's like,
I love that.
What Friday the 13th has, I call it the gift that keeps on giving, because this movie gave me a private wine label.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic.
Which honestly I say was never on my vision board. I you know, how could I have ever projected that? You know, and it's just like, what? The joy that this movie has ultimately been able to give me is quite amazing. Even with the final girls, the title Final Girls, I'm going to come up with a new, we have a new wine, a white blend. It's a proprietal varietal, three varietals that go into it, and we're going to call it Final Girls Glow. And that's what I mean. I get inspired.
Ooh.
By different. I have my Survivor Syrah, which was obviously inspired by Alice. I have the Voorhees Vengeance Viognier, which was inspired by Mrs. Voorhees.
That's so awesome.
And on the label, that because I paint the label, so on the label it has the back of Mrs. Voorhees. You know, that famous pose where she's looking across the lake?
Yeah.
Well, she's looking across the lake, holding a glass of wine, toasting to the lovely day of watching the children swimming in the lake with her son. You see, it. One glass of wine changes everything.
Yeah, like what if Mrs. Voorhees had just relaxed a little bit?
Right? So I'm able to create my own little world. I create my own little Friday the 13th what if world with Crystal Lake Wines.
That's amazing. And where can people get Crystal Lake Wines?
Oh, you can do it on my website, adrianking.com or crystallakewines.com. I'm in, as you know, I have no cells where I live. I live in real wine country in Southern Oregon. We have no cells here. The winery has cells. It's a few miles from my hood here, but from my cabin right here in the woods. But I'm at the winery, and if you contact me, you know, I'll make sure I'm there to meet you and pour you a glass.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's Valley View Winery in Jacksonville, Oregon. And Crystal Lake Wines has a Crystal Lake Wine Corner with all the different, varietals. And on crystallakewines.com, you'll see the listings and the descriptions of the wines and the wine labels and how much fun I have with them. And, it's like I said, it's just something I never would have expected, but I'm busier than I ever expected to be. I thought I was retired when we moved up to Oregon 15 years ago now, and that's the same year Crystal Lake Memories, the book, came out. So I've never been busier between Crystal Lake Wines and the fun little films that I get to pick and choose and be part of. Life could not be better. Oh, and married to the ultimate husband for 35 years, who was George Romero's distributor. Richard Hassanin, my husband, was the founder and president of United Film Distribution. So
oh,
he has
wow.
quite a yeah. And we met a children's charity within the theatrical cinema called Variety Children's Charity, and that's how we met. And we were married in 1987. And who would have thunk, right?
Wow! Congratulations. That's amazing.
It's something else wonderful that came out of her.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Like it really is the gift that keeps on giving, for sure.
Yeah, I think all the final girls, the first final girls, all their marriages are into the 30 years now.
That's amazing. I love hearing that. I really do. I just want to wrap up a little bit, Adrian, with talking about. Real quick, another horror movie that you're in that it's the first of an incredibly successful franchise as well, but not too many people may know that you were in it. You were a stunt woman in Ghostbusters.
Oh, yes. Oh, that's so funny, Natasha, you bring that up.
I read that. I was like, what? That's amazing.
What? Well, you know, actors, they have to be able to do lots of different things. So, you know, because you never know where you're going to end up. People say, how did you pick her? Well, no, horror chose me, as an
actor.
That's
how it is.
For everything. And horror chose me, and I was lucky. You know that? I was damn lucky because, like I said, who else gets to go and be loved every weekend if they wanted to? By their fans. But in 83, probably. I think it was right before London actually, Rod. I'm trying to figure it out. But I didn't make enough because, needless to say, you had to make a certain amount for Screen Actors Guild to kick in health insurance. And unfortunately, Screen Actors Guild had a waiver for actors on Part 2 and Part 1. We did not participate in any of the what actors now participate in, which is residuals from the movies themselves. So I actually get more from the little pieces I was in that they used, reused in part four, then one and two combined.
Wow.
And believe me, I tell you what I get before is minuscule. So, but anyway, compared to, you know, what it would have been. But Ghostbusters, God love Ghostbusters. I did 2 weeks of stunt work because the man, his name was Cliff Cudney, who actually was the stunt director on part two, was a friend of a friend whose name, Tony. His friend was, my friend was Tony, and he said, and you hear that panic almost as I forgot his name. Tony Ferrantino, that was his name, and he was a stuntman, and he introduced me to Cliff, and Cliff said, have you had any experience? And I said, well, I was the one who starred in Friday the 13th, and I did my own stunts, and he goes, you're hired.
You thought Mrs. Voorhees, you're hired.
No more need to be said. You're worthy. And I said, oh, thank you. And so, anyway, I was in so many different parts of Ghostbusters, but you never see me, which is, you know, the way that they want extras and to be and some people basically not to be, you know, noticeable. But I jumped in front of a cab on Madison Avenue. That was fun. Or jumped away from a cab, I should say. Captain Scott would not be a smart move, no. And I was slimed. I was slimed a lot.
Oh, that's so fun.
Oh, it was great. It was absolutely great. So, yeah, I make more from Ghostbusters. Oh, my God, Ghostbusters saved me many a time because that I got what I should, really should have gotten, you know, as opposed to people playing with numbers and stuff like that. Why does it make a difference? Yeah. So God bless Ghostbusters. And my 2 weeks don't work. It saved me. It saved me, and it kept my health insurance alive while I played around and studied in London. Is basically what happened. So yeah, thank you, Ghostbusters.
Yeah, wow, that's so amazing. You're in two very very famous franchises, and
right?
You know, and they are like, you know, to this day we love both of those movies so much, and they're, you know, so ingrained in our culture, and, you know, just the fans love them. And
exactly.
It's just,
and I
so
looped
cool.
on Titanic. How do you like that?
What?
For 2 weeks. My scream is throughout Titanic. You can hear me screaming and singing in different languages.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Adrian King is in Titanic, Ghostbusters, Friday the 13th.
You know. You know, I was told once that Bay Ray made something like 300 films or over 300 films, but you only remember her for one of them. That's how I hit, you know. I just do a few big films, and, you know, and then I drink wine.
Yeah,
and then,
so,
and then I paint in my studio all day, you know. Natasha, I am living the life. I'm telling you, if you come to Oregon, you have an open invite. We just have the best time here.
Aww.
We stomp grapes. We do. We stomp grapes during harvest. I mean, it's really so much fun.
Love it. Well, I'll have to check that out. And you know,
you will.
Everybody,
totally.
You know, go check it out and check out Crystal Lake Wines and AdrianKing.com for all your Adrian needs, and go say hi to her if you're in the area. And Adrian, oh my gosh, thank you so much for taking the time to chat.
It was so much fun. Thank you for letting me trot down memory lane.
Class Of is a Fangoria Podcast Network original, hosted, edited, and produced by Natasha Pesetta. Executive producers Dallas Sanye and Phil Nobile Jr. Associate producer Jessica Safa Vamare. Music by James Malone. Art and design by Ashley Detmering. For Fangoria, Brandon Wynardi and Jason Koslerich. With special thanks to Tom Savini.